In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about the future of the American space program. And our guest is Dr. Robert Zubrin. He is an engineer. His academic training is in nuclear engineering and in aeronautics and astronautics. He has degrees in both from the University of Washington. He's a former member of NASA's Mars Exploration Long-Term Strategy Working Group. He is also editor for Mars Exploration of the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society. He spent a number of years as an engineer at Lockheed Martin Astronautics in Denver, where he was working on the design of advanced space transportation and propulsion concepts. And in his writing and speaking, he has been a very strong advocate for some time now for the exploration of space. He is the author of two books. They include The Case for Mars, How We Shall Settle the Red Planet and Why We Must. That's a book that was published by Simon & Schuster's Free Press Division back in 1996. And also the book Entering Space, Creating a Spacefaring Civilization, published by Tarcher Putnam in the fall or summer. Late summer, August, to be precise, August of 1999. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, as usual, questions are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, comments, certainly people are welcome to call. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many people as possible. But callers are certainly welcome. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Dr. Zubrin, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
I guess I should say again, because we have talked before. I am sure that we talked about the most recent book about entering space on this program. So I'm glad that you could be with us again. Mm-hmm. Perhaps as a way of starting out, a little bit of an overview about where things stand now with America's space program. And it certainly seems that there have been significant challenges over the last few years, some achievements as well to point to, but it seems that it's up and down. You know, the pendulum swings back and forth between people who argue that somehow NASA is in crisis, and we have periods like that, and then we have periods where people are saying, well, NASA has bounced back, and it's re-energized, and it's moving ahead, and then maybe we have another crisis. And it seems like we go back and forth between those two poles, or at least have. So is it actually possible to give your assessment about where NASA and where the American space program is right at the moment?
Well, it's between those two points at this point. Of course, we had the Columbia accident, and we had basically a string of gross mismanagement decisions by the former NASA administrator, Sean O'Keefe, that led to his removal and his replacement by somebody who is far more capable. The current administrator, Mike Griffin, is actually somebody who really is qualified to be NASA administrator and is not just some political camp follower who got stuck in the job. So we have the prospect now of a NASA that can really accomplish something. We also have a new strategic policy for NASA, so-called Vision for Space Exploration, put forth by the Bush administration in early 2004, which calls for reorienting the manned space program towards human exploration of the moon and then Mars. Mr. O'Keefe, while he remained in office, succeeded in basically wasting time and not implementing that vision. It remains to be seen whether Mike Griffin will be able to get it off the ground. And then finally, there is additional outstanding challenges. The most important of one is the repair and upgrade of the Hubble Space Telescope. Mr. O'Keefe, the former administrator, rather than being willing to accept the risk of a mission to Hubble, which is no more risky than any other shuttle mission, but not part of the space station program, decided to abandon the Hubble Space Telescope, which is the only real accomplishment of the manned space program in the last 30 years, but which is a very substantial accomplishment. And Griffin has stated that it's his inclination to, in fact, mount the Hubble repair mission. And I think he absolutely should. There are those who say that in view of the fact that the data from the recent shuttle mission showed that the problem that caused the Columbia accident was not completely solved, that the shuttle mission should be suspended for a significant period of time. I'm not in sympathy with that position at all. The shuttle program at $4 billion a year gets a budget equal to the entire U.S. cancer research budget. And if it's important enough to take that amount of funds that could be used for those kinds of purposes to accomplish its goals, then those goals are important enough to risk some shuttle crews at 2% risk per mission, which is the documented risk rate, assuming that there's been no improvement to shuttle safety whatsoever. That is subjecting, say, 5 shuttle crews, 35 people, to a 2% risk. If the missions are not important enough to be worth that, then they're not important enough to merit the whole U.S. cancer research budget.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got to decide one way or the other. If the shuttle program is worth it, they got to fly it.
Well, let's talk about the shuttle and about what's going to come next, because I think that there seems to be this idea that no matter what we do to try to patch up the vehicles that we have and to make it possible for them to continue to fly for a while, that something is going to have to be designed to replace it. The big question seems to be, well, what? What is going to be the next thing? What is going to replace the shuttle?
Well, the key question is, what is our actual goal? Okay? Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be designing things. We should be designing plans. Okay? Now, if our plan is to go to the moon and Mars, then we design systems that are suitable for that. The problem with the shuttle is not that it's unsafe. I mean, it is unsafe. But spaceflight is going to be unsafe. I mean, when you fly to orbit, you put an amount of energy into each person and each nut and bolt equal to that person's weight in, not that person's weight, almost 10 times that person's weight in TNT. Okay, and when you instill that kind of energy into any person, every object, that's dangerous, and it's going to be dangerous, okay? It's going to be dangerous when we go to the moon, and it's going to be dangerous when we go to Mars. The question is to be actually doing missions that are worthy of the kind of danger that space flight requires. Now, that's why I brought up the Hubble repair mission, okay? The Hubble mission is clearly worth flying. You're talking about the greatest astronomical observatory in human history, one that has changed our notion of what the laws of the universe are. It is worth the $4 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money that went into it. That's as much as we spend for a new nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Okay, to abandon a sinking aircraft carrier rather than expose 7 volunteers to a 2% risk would result in the court-martial of the officer who made such a decision. So abandoning Hubble is the same thing. So clearly, if you have something which is worth doing, which is that much worth doing, then it's worth taking a risk for. And, of course, the astronauts are all volunteers. Now, whether or not these other shuttle missions to the space station are really worth the money we're paying for them, which is to say, because if they're worth the money we're paying for them, then they're worth the risk of 2% to the crew that flies them, because we're paying almost $1 billion each for these missions. On the other hand, if they're not really worth what we're paying for them, if they're not worth anything, then they're not worth any risk at all. And so that said, if our goal is the moon and Mars, then we need to design a set of space flight systems that can achieve those goals. We need a heavy lift launch vehicle. A heavy lift launch vehicle could, in fact, be readily created by taking the shuttle launch stack and getting rid of the orbiter and replacing it with a hydrogen oxygen upper stage, and we could get a Saturn V equivalent vehicle. And that is the most convincing argument, actually, for preserving the shuttle industrial infrastructure at this point, because it can be converted for heavy lift. But that said, then that's what we should do. There are plans right now to just keep flying the shuttles for 5 years on and off whenever we can break through these launch holds that will reoccur, and just pay a certain amount of money to create, to preserve the shuttle industrial infrastructure, and then start developing a heavy lift vehicle in 2010. This is, in fact, the Bush policy, but it doesn't make any sense. You're basically wasting 5 years of the manned spaceflight program, which is to say $30 billion, to stay in place. If we have a different objective than what we had when we initiated the shuttle and station programs, which was to experience spaceflight, if we understand that space is simply not something to be appreciated by being in and, encountering zero gravity health effects, but rather space is a medium whose chief importance is that it is something that you fly across to reach worlds on the other side, then the current set of systems should essentially be abandoned immediately, and we should develop heavy lift vehicles. We should develop a small crew capsule like the one we used in Apollo to allow for a crew reentry at very high velocities from return from the moon or the planets. And we should develop habitation modules that we can use to live in on the moon or on Mars or on the way to Mars.
Let me just introduce very quickly our guest, reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580, Dr. Robert Zubrin. He is an engineer trained in astronautics and aeronautics and nuclear engineering. He worked for NASA. He's a former member of the Mars Exploration Long-Term Strategy Working Group. He's also worked on the design of advanced space transportation and propulsion concepts and has been, as you probably can tell by listening to him for some time, a very strong advocate for the exploration of space, for going back to the moon and also to Mars. And he's written about this in a couple of books. I just mentioned again the most recent, which is titled Entering Space, Creating a Space-Faring Civilization.
That actually, I have another one that's more recent than that.
Oh, my apologies then. What's the title of that?
Okay, the first book was Mars was The Case for Mars.
Right.
Second book was Entering Space. Mm-hmm. And the third book is entitled Mars on Earth, The Adventures of Space Pioneers in the High Arctic. And that's about the work of the Mars Society, a private organization, and setting up a simulated Mars station up 900 miles from the North Pole. They set up a simulated Mars station there and have been conducting Mars missions in the polar desert to learn how to explore.
All right, indeed. Well, if people are interested, they can head out to the bookstores and look for those
right.
books. And questions are welcome here, too, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, to talk a little bit about going back to the moon and going to Mars, as far as the moon is concerned, we've been there. I guess my understanding would be that we know how to do that. That's the technical challenges aren't quite so great there. When we're talking about going to Mars, it's something else. It's further that, although I guess the actually working on Mars is not quite as difficult as working on the moon. But is the big problem here technical? Are the issues technical, or is it more a matter of deciding that first of all that we want to do it, and then we have to decide how we're going to pay for it?
Well, first of all, the big problem is political, okay? It's a problem of having a political leadership that has the guts to take on this challenge. I have to say that in comparing the President Bush's announcement of his vision for space exploration to Kennedy's announcement of the Apollo program in 1961, it seems like we've become a nation of Lilliputians compared to who we used to be. Kennedy committed us to the moon in 8 years at a time when this country had 15 minutes of human spaceflight experience. We didn't even know if people could eat in space, let alone whether they could go to the moon. Okay, but he had the guts to commit us to that and do it within the decade, which is, say, within 8 years of his speech. President Bush, in January 2004, said, waved the flag and said, "I have a vision," and it was to return to the moon by 2020, 16 years, twice as long as it took us to go there the first time when we didn't even know how to do it. And Mars, which is the Proxima challenge, and we are much better technologically ready today to send humans to Mars than we were to send men to the moon in 1961. So going to Mars today is a smaller challenge than going to the moon was in 1961. And that's postponed for the indefinite future. So what we have here is a real lack of courage. And it's a costly lack of courage because, for example, the way they positioned the vision, so-called, was, as I mentioned, to spend the next 5 years essentially accomplishing nothing, continuing business as usual with the shuttle and the station, neither of which have any role in a moon program. And $30 billion out the window and 5 years. And then after that, starting on a 10-year moon program, which is even then longer than it took to go there. So basically, cowardice is costly, you know, and I think this is a real question of social values. You know, I saw on the news yesterday these FEMA people cutting and running on evacuating people because a few shots were fired at them by looters in Louisiana. So to preserve their own safety, they let tens of thousands of people die. And that's unacceptable. We have to have values in this country that celebrate courage, and we have to have a space program. The space program should be the epitome of that.
Hmm. Well, I'm not sure in New Orleans we're at the point where tens of thousands of people have died, but...
No, they haven't died yet, but they're going to if they are allowed to stay stranded in those houses and on roofs.
But I guess that we're... We have a couple of callers here ready to go, and I'm fully expecting whenever we talk about a subject like this to hear from someone who says it's not worth spending even a dime on it, and that what we really should be doing is working on addressing the needs of people here on the Earth, and why spend our money on such a foolish thing as going to Mars. I'm sure we're going to hear that. So that gets at the question, you know, perhaps one question is why do it at all, but it also gets to this question, well, if we reallocated the money that we're spending now on space, would that be sufficient to do it? How much more would we have to spend? Really, what kind of money are we talking about?
Well, number one, yes, we could do it by reallocating the money we're spending now on space. Between shuttle and station, we're spending $6 billion a year. That's more than twice as much as we need to mount a competent Humans to Mars program.
All right, so it would not mean an additional expenditure.
No, not unless you also chose to keep in place the current wasteful programs. But no, you could do this within the budget that NASA currently has.
Yeah. So then the other question that we're left with is the why do it at all question.
Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, first of all, this is science. We're going to find out whether we're alone in the universe, whether life as we know it on Earth is the pattern for all life everywhere, or whether we're just one branch of a much more vast and interesting tapestry. We're going to talk about the intellectual capital that would be developed would more than pay for the program, if you want to think in dollars and cents terms. That is, you know, during Apollo in the 60s, when we had a real space program, the number of science graduates in this country doubled at every level, high school, college, PhD, and that produced millions of scientists, engineers, inventors, doctors, medical researchers that have advanced the country in every way, from medical cures to defense systems to new industries. It's about creating the future. I mean, look, you know, humans are going to expand into space, okay? And there's a question here. What people will those be? What values will they celebrate? Will they be people who celebrate the values of Western humanism, or will they celebrate Islamic fundamentalism, okay, or the Chinese totalitarianism? What is the nature of the human future? We speak English because the English went forth from their little island and spread their culture around the world, and which has then evolved in different ways in different places, but which, on the whole, has been a very positive development. Imagine what had happened if the Ottoman Turks had been the one to settle the New World.
Well, I imagine you get some arguments from some people about whether or not that would necessarily have been worse.
Well, then they're stupid.
Better.
They're stupid. I mean, if they think that living in a purdah is preferable to the kind of life that Americans have today, then they don't know anything.
Well, put your flak jacket on. We're going to take some calls now. Let's go to line one. It's a cell phone caller. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm going to try to be very, very nice. A dime is too much. And every question that the guest has brought up means that I don't need an answer for any of those questions he brought up about is there anybody out there or is there life out there and we can learn from them. I don't need answers to those kind of questions. And the amount of money we're spending there, and just look around this country and tell me, can we spend that money more wisely somewhere else? And I really got some problems here.
Okay, let me answer it. Number one, I'm actually partly in sympathy with you because the way the space budget is being spent now, there certainly are wiser ways we could spend it somewhere else. Okay, so actually you don't have an argument for me on that. Okay, frankly, the way the shuttle and space station budget has been spent, I would just as soon spend it on highway repairs or armor for the troops or, you know, you name it. Any program at all, practically, would be certainly more worthwhile. However, just because the money is being wasted on the space program in the way it's being spent now doesn't mean that it couldn't be spent and that there, in a wise way, and that there is a goal worth pursuing that, in fact, is very important. And that goal is the shape of the human future. And yes, there are very real needs in our society today, in this country and around the world. But just because there are people hungry today does not negate the need to save seed corn for next year.
Well, I don't know, caller. That probably doesn't satisfy your concerns.
That doesn't satisfy me. I think they should slash the budget and make them do with what they can, you know, they should cut the budget back for the space program, because at this point in time, you know, that's not going to mean anything to anybody down there in the states that are fighting with the hurricane. It's not going to fight with anybody around here with the $3 gas. It's not going to matter to.
Well, actually, no, that's not true, sir. In fact,
well, it is.
Oh, no, wait a second. 80% of the people in New Orleans were saved by the space program because those satellite pictures that let us know the path and strength of that hurricane and when it was coming that allowed the mayor to make the announcement, evacuate the city, which was an extreme announcement, which no one would make without certain knowledge of the danger that was coming. Okay, we got 80% of the people out of that town because of the warning provided
on the
by the space program.
Yeah, and walking
sir.
On the moon or walking on Mars is going to make a difference. Well, you go down there right now and tell those people that you want to increase the budget and spend more money at NASA and do different things and see what happens.
Well, okay, and I appreciate the comments of the caller. Obviously, you have strong concerns, and so does the guest. And I think I'm going to jump in here because I don't think it'd be profitable for us to go much further. Let's go to another caller here, Chicago. This is the next person, line number 4. Hello, caller there in Chicago.
The question of values is certainly prominent in all the discussion now, and to say. Conditions on Earth need remedy, and we want to maybe perhaps put a colony on the moon and maybe venture out to the edge of our capacity to Mars. You know, we haven't even designed or developed a suit that can exist in the atmosphere of Mars, as I understand it. We've been able, fortunately, to deal with that situation up to the moon, but they actually have not developed a suit that the astronauts could wear on the environment and wind forces that I think are a hurricane year-round on Mars, as I understand it. Now, maybe other factors would mitigate the strength of that wind velocity, but they actually haven't gotten around to, design or develop a suit that would withstand under those conditions. And, I think we have to develop the sort of, can we reestablish a colony to take the place of New Orleans somewhere on this planet, let alone think of a colony on the moon before we do much else. Thank you.
Well, let me ask you.
Let me just answer the first part.
Yeah, do that.
Easier to answer.
Yeah.
We certainly have spacesuits that can operate on Mars. No, the wind forces on Mars, are on the surface of Mars, are not that great. It does get sometimes to very high winds aloft on Mars, and those create dust storms that obscure solar energy, so you'd need nuclear power on the surface of Mars if you wanted reliable power. But the suits that we used in Apollo would operate on Mars. The problem with Mars spacesuits right now is not do we have a suit that would do equivalent things on Mars that we did on the moon. What we need are spacesuits that can be used again and again and maintained by a small team of people on Mars rather than a staff of 100 people at Johnson Space Center refitting them after being worn three times. So, there's some technology development to be done there to create a spacesuit that would be useful to a crew that would be on Mars for a year, year and a half at a time. It's not like that's something we can't do. I mean, it's something that we need to do, sure. The question that keeps coming up, is this question of the needs of the future versus the needs of the present. Well, as I mentioned before, first of all, those are hard to put against each other, a lot of the needs of the present are being met by the investments that we made in the space program in the past. I mean, if you look at CNN, in the days before Katrina hit, and you constantly saw that graphic of a color whirling hurricane approaching the shore, where did that image come from? That came from our space program. That's where that came from. And that's what allowed 80% of the population of the city to be evacuated. Now, furthermore, as I also mentioned, the intellectual capital created by the space program is tremendous. But the wealth of a nation is dependent upon its intellectual capital. The space program has been a tremendous generator of intellectual capital, especially during the Apollo period, somewhat not as much during the recent period because it hasn't had the same kind of bold character to it. But if we had a Humans to Mars program, that would say to every young person in this country, learn your science and you can become part of pioneering a new world. And out of that, we'd get millions of scientifically educated people that would create industries, doctors, inventors, engineers. These are the people that make our country strong, whether it's for economic purposes, military purposes, for the purposes of finding medical cures that advance the human condition. Okay? I'd be very surprised if a lot of those doctors that are treating those people down there in the South and elsewhere, or the medical researchers that develop the cures that they're implementing, were not encouraged to go into biology by the excitement they had over science because of what was going on in our space program in the 1960s when they were growing up.
Well, let me introduce again our guest. We have some other callers. We'll get to them. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Dr. Robert Zubrin. He is president of Pioneer Astronautics. He's a former engineer from NASA. Mm-hmm. He has degrees in aeronautics, astronautics, and nuclear engineering from University of Washington. While he was at NASA, he was a member of the Mars Exploration Long-Term Strategy Working Group. He's also editor for Mars Exploration of the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society. Also worked at Lockheed Martin Astronautics, working on the design of advanced space transportation and propulsion concepts, and is the author of three books, all very strongly advocating the human involvement in space and going out into space. His books are The Case for Mars, Entering Space, and the most recent, Mars on Earth, The Adventures of Space Pioneers in the High Arctic. You can look for his books in the bookstore. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in nearby community, Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Hello. More comment today. It seems, though, the basic problem with what where we're not being able to go where we want is that we have an administration who has made nothing but improper decisions, from improper energy policy, improper decisions after 9/11, and now very faulty improper decisions after this. We need to move on. Thank you.
All right. I don't know. You want to say anything, make any comment on that, Dr. Zubrin?
Well, I'm actually politically independent, and I have criticisms of both parties, but it's certainly the case that the current Bush space policy is only half a step in the right direction, and it basically says we're going to continue to have the wrong space policy for the next 5 years, and then we'll start a better policy in 2011, should the people in power at that time choose to do so. So, I think that the strategic direction of the space program is inadequate, but I wouldn't ascribe this simply to a problem of Mr. Bush. It was also inadequate under Mr. Clinton as well.
All right, let's go to the next caller, and this is someone in Ogden, Illinois, line number two. Hello.
Hello, this is important to me, very. I look at our world from many years of being here on Earth, and what I see is that we are becoming overpopulating all the areas of the Earth, and if we don't continue our NASA research and go into space and find other planets, our Earth is going to die from us. And I feel that this is a very important project, and if it's not continued, we can all see our what's happening now. Our farmland is taken over from working on the farmland to duplexes, and I'm very frightened of our future here on Earth, and I think if we move on into space and gain some knowledge of how to live in space and have maybe space stations from one planet to another or from one spot to another, it might be a wiser idea to do that than to stay on Earth and watch our children go hungry and watch the old die. It's really important to me on this subject to go ahead on to Mars and then to other planets. That's all I have.
Well, all right. I appreciate the comment. Dr. Zubrin, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think the comment is fundamentally well taken. It's really a question of whether we have an open future or a closed future. You know, in an odd sense, it could be said that humans are not really native to the Earth. We're native to Kenya. I mean, that's where we originated, in the Kenyan Rift Valley. We're tropical animals. That's why we have these long, thin arms with no fur on them. No human being could survive a single winter night in Illinois without technology such as clothing, fire, houses. These are inventions. This is what allowed us to leave our natural habitat, which is the African tropics, to colonize the Earth. But think how limited the human prospect would be if we had stayed in our natural habitat of the Kenyan Rift Valley. If we had survived at all in such a limited domain, you know, a small collection of tribes and a local area, I mean, how diverse could human culture today be? I mean, we certainly wouldn't have a worldwide civilization with 150 languages and, you know, literatures and histories, and the whole human story would be a much poorer affair, and without all those different nations, there wouldn't be the different inventions that came from those nations. I mean, we'd be impoverished in every sense. So the idea of an open human future with new branches of human civilization coming to be on new worlds offers a much more optimistic prospect for the human future.
Hmm. Well, certainly people have been imagining this, humans going out in numbers into space for some time, and humans have done it in small numbers, but I guess it seems to me to be a pretty big leap from the idea of establishing some sort of a small permanent settlement on Mars or on the moon and perhaps going to Mars, a big leap from there to the idea of people in any significant numbers going out and establishing some kind of permanent colonies in space. I mean, I know one can imagine that, but if you try to think in a realistic sense, given all of the various challenges, technological and otherwise, whether you could really imagine such a thing happening within even the next few centuries.
No, it could be done. Actually, in my book, The Case for Mars, I address exactly this question, that, you know, if you had really for once you establish a Mars base and it develops its own agriculture and greenhouses, the ability to make local materials, steel, glass, plastics, and so on, and you start sending people to Mars, if you send on the order of 100 people a year to Mars, which really could be done for a budget comparable to NASA's current budget, and natural population growth would increase the population of Mars at about the same rate that the European population increased in America in the 1600s and 1700s. And now, don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about relocating a large population from Earth to Mars. I'm not talking about, some people talk about, but I don't, solving the Earth's population pressure by taking large numbers of people from Earth and putting them on another world. I don't think that'll happen at all. Just as the large majority of Europeans by far stayed in Europe, only a tiny minority came to America. Nevertheless, America was colonized and a new branch of human civilization emerged here.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with some other folks. We'll go next to Coal City, line 4. Right here, line 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay. You know, I agree with her 100% on space exploration. The only trouble is, during 1962 and under Kennedy administration, we was feeding upon ourselves. Now what we're doing is we're taking, like the robot arm that they got on the space shuttle that's made in Canada and ain't doing this country no good and ain't putting people to work in this, you know, in this country. We're building up other countries. We're getting our work outside the country, which don't do us no good. And if it don't do us no good, it's no use having it, because we're not putting Americans to work, we're not using American ingenuity, we're not using American minds, and we're not using American math. We're just about like the guy on Microsoft that imports his workers from India in place of getting college students from India to be computer scientists. Bill Gates. I mean, what good would the space program do for us if we're exporting all our work to get it done?
Yeah. Well, let's
feed upon yourself. If we feed upon ourselves, I would be 100% for it. But we got too many people in this country that need help.
Well, I think the caller makes an interesting point, and I'm interested, Dr. Zubrin, in having you address it. And I guess the way my way of thinking about it is it would actually be possible for the United States to do what it is you're talking about, go back to the moon and go to the Mars and just do it and have it just be an effort by the United States? Or would one way or another this have to be an international effort?
No, the United States could do it by itself. But I favor an international effort, although constructed somewhat differently from the way our current international effort is constructed. The caller is partially correct, although only partially. There is a certain fraction of the U.S. space budget that is going, and I'd have to argue in an improper way, outside the country, and I'm talking about in particular to prop up the corrupt Russian government. A lot of the space station budget is shipped over to Russia, and you can see these $500,000 deiches going up around the Russian space centers, and that's all money gets grafted by these Russian officials. And the whole thing was done to prop up the Yeltsin government, and it's even propping up the Putin government, and that's wrong. But that's less than 5% of the NASA budget. It is a scandal, and it shouldn't happen. But that the large majority of the budget is in fact spent in the United States, and it does help support U.S. Aerospace industry, which is, of course, critical part of our national defense. Absolutely critical part of our national defense. Now, there's another problem, though, with the current internationalization of the program, which is that we have become enmeshed with the Europeans in the space station program. And in fact, the excuse that the Bush administration uses, believe it or not, as to why they can't break off the space station program and start immediately on the moon and Mars, which is their stated goal, which the space station has essentially no relationship to, is because we have obligations to our European partners to continue the space station program. Now, you know, it does ring a bit hollow, coming especially from the Bush administration, that they should let their policy be determined by the French. But nevertheless, that's how they're conducting the space program with respect to its strategic objectives, not in accord with American objectives, but in accord with some sorts of international agreements which do not correspond anymore to American objectives. And I don't like that. Now, that said, okay, United States could fully afford to send humans to Mars on its own. I think, though, we should encourage the Europeans to form their own program and fly to Mars in convoy with us, and the Japanese and Russians as well. Everyone can bring their own ship, and that way, instead of having one crew of 5 on Mars, we'll have 4. And, you know, we can go and visit the European crew at Christmas and have drinks together, and but or more seriously, the crews can back each other up if they get into trouble, and we and different crews can make different discoveries, and the program as a whole will be richer for it. But we don't need to depend on them, and we certainly don't need to give them our money.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest again, Dr. Robert Zubrin. He's president of Pioneer Astronautics, has his background in aeronautics, astronautics, nuclear engineering. He worked for NASA. He was part of the working group that was interested in developing a long-term strategy for Mars exploration. He's also worked for Lockheed Martin on the design of advanced space transportation and propulsion, and is author of three books about space exploration, including The Case for Mars, second book, Entering Space, Creating a Space-Faring Civilization. The most recent is titled Mars on Earth, The Adventures of Space Pioneers in the High Arctic. We have other callers. Next, we'll go to someone in Chicago, I believe, and this should be line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I sort of want to reflect again about what the last caller said and perhaps put it in another way. As someone who at best has disinterest in the space program, it comes from two reasons. And the first one is that you may use the example that the space program has helped 80% of the people in New Orleans, but what is distressing is that there was no plan for 20% of the people. And I guess what always happens when I look at the space program and the proposed benefits from it is that I see 100% of public funds going into programs that we're lucky if they help as many as 80%. But usually, such as the space shuttle program, I'm not even sure if that's affecting 1%. And so that's the first part as a taxpayer, is that somehow these programs never seem to be visualized in any way to help maximum people and support our society in any way. The second problem that I have is that as the problem of simply pollution, it seems like every time we do something like this, I'm looking at the exploration we're having in the Arctic, we simply pollute. And I'm also, you know, when they said that the last space shuttle, they thought it was being hit by space debris, I almost jumped out of my chair. It's like, what? How in the world do we think we're going anywhere when we seem to be polluting our new frontier almost faster than we've polluted the old frontier? So I guess those are the two problems, the almost cavalier way in which we do it and the fact that there doesn't seem to be a real thought that if you're using 100% public funds, you need to have programs that will affect eventually 100% of the population.
Well, Dr. Zubrin, you want to respond to that?
Well, yeah. I have to actually, one of the things about NASA that is better than the NASA of the 1960s is in attempting to address precisely this question. There has been a tremendous effort at NASA to recruit female astronauts, Afro-American and Asian astronauts, and also not just astronauts, but personnel running missions, the unmanned program, astronomers, managers, engineers, that NASA today really does reflect America. And when, a woman astronaut speaks to, you know, a high school or, a black astronaut or whatever, they show people who in previous generations might have considered themselves excluded from the advanced technical professions that really that they can do it. And indeed they can. I mean, in NASA right now, the percents of these groups that are hired are fully representative of their percentages in the American public. And so so it's not just a few examples for show at all. So I would say that NASA actually is doing a lot to open up the scientific professions to women and minorities, that it's not just a white boys game anymore. And I think that's good. That means that a Humans to Mars program today would actually have a much bigger social impact than the Apollo program did in the 60s. Because in the 1960s, the adventure going to the moon excited millions of young white boys to want to become scientists, now it would excite not only them, but also the girls and minorities and everyone else. So I think that actually that's being that was a real problem, but that's being addressed. And
I think unless NASA is also funding money into our poor public schools, you won't have an African American or a woman scientist to choose from.
Well,
so
no,
that's
actually,
what I mean
that,
about
that,
the 100%.
No, that's not. That's, look, I got to tell you. I mean, right now, the thing. You know, I used to be a teacher, actually, and I taught in black high schools. And I also taught in white high schools of various qualities, some good and some really not very good. And I can tell you, the thing that determines success in education is the morale of the students. Anybody can teach students who want to learn, and nobody can teach students who don't want to learn. And that's the bottom line. And it doesn't matter whether you're dealing with a chalk on the blackboard or an LCD projector or all these knickknacks. They are entirely secondary to whether the students want to learn or not. And if you have something going on, like a Humans to Mars program that is offering science as an adventure to these kids, you have the potential to draw much more of them into it. And this, in fact, you know, $2 billion a year would be a drop in the bucket spent in the educational system. But if it caused a million kids a year to major in science, and that would be across the board now, lots of girls, lots of minorities would go into it, not just boys, then the educational impact, in fact, would be superior than direct spending in the educational system.
So you're saying that NASA is putting $2 million, or I'm sorry.
No, no. What I'm saying is this. Okay. You got 100 million, no, excuse me, that's not correct. You got around 50 million kids in school right now in the United States at one level or another, okay, from kindergarten through under college senior. And then over the next 10 years, there'll be another 50 million, so that's 100 million. If over those 10 years, a Humans to Mars program was to cause 1% of them to go into science that wouldn't have gone into it before, that's a million extra scientists, inventors, engineers, doctors, medical researchers. Okay, that's huge. And you could do that, okay, at a cost, say, of $2 billion a year, or really not at much of a cost at all, because if you did it by redirecting the shuttle money, but we'll call it a cost, $2 billion a year. That's $20 billion. $2 billion a year scattered among 50 million students is, what, like $40 a student? That would pay for an extra textbook or something. That's not very much. In other words, the space program has the potential to actually affect students' lives by inspiring them. And sometimes the indirect approach is more effective than the direct approach. And I think the space program, if it's properly directed, that money will do more for education than simply distributing it to schools.
And I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in, because we're almost out of time. We have maybe a minute or two left. I would like to try to include at least one more caller. And so we'll go to the next person in line. It's a listener in Chicago on line 3. Hello.
Hi. I basically agree with your position that much of NASA is being bungled, many of its programs are being bungled and have been for a long time. Now, my position is based on information that I've gotten from a person who was with NASA for over 30 years, and basically his feeling is that NASA has deteriorated since the Nixon administration, when emphasis was placed on making the whole operation controlled by commercial enterprise and commercial interest. And from that point on, from the Nixon administration on, the NASA administration has been deteriorating, and he felt that after the first 5 or 6 years with NASA, he was wasting his life. He got very few assignments. The people who were running NASA eventually were the industries, and they were running it for a profit. They weren't interested in accumulating scientific knowledge primarily, and as a result, problems arose, and we're at that point at this point.
And I've got to get a comment here from the guest because we're almost out of time. What do you think about that, Dr. Zubrin?
Well, I'd modify a word here or there, but he's right. There was a drastic change in the direction of NASA at the end of Apollo. During Apollo, we had a mission-driven organization. The agency had a goal, and it conducted its activities to the purpose of achieving that goal. After Apollo, without a goal, it became a constituency-driven organization whose purpose was to serve its vendors. Okay, it's like the difference. Imagine two couples that each want to build their own dream house. And the first couple has a plan. They hire an architect. He designs the house, and they go and buy the parts that build the house. Okay, that's couple A. Couple B, they go and they poll their neighbors and local store owners on what house parts they might have for sale that could plausibly be used as part of a house, and they buy those that are most convincingly marketed to them, and they accumulate the junk in the backyard. That's been NASA since the end of Apollo. In order for NASA to accomplish anything, it has to have a goal. It's got to be a mission-driven organization, not a vendor-driven organization.
All right, there we're going to have to leave it. Once again, our guest, Dr. Robert Zubrin, he's president of Pioneer Astronautics, former engineer at NASA. If you're interested in reading some of his writing about space exploration, you can look for his most recent book, Mars on Earth, The Adventures of Space Pioneers in the High Arctic, or the one before that, Entering Space, Creating a Spacefaring Civilization, published by Tarcher Putnam in 1999. Dr. Zubrin, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. And one more thing. If they want to know about what they can do to help advance the space program, there's an organization called the Mars Society they can get involved with, and the website for that is marssociety.org.
All right. Thank you.